The North Carolina Reading Service provides this following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It is the Independent Indie Week, read by John Federson today and this issue, October the 2nd of 2025. All right, we will get started with the issue in about 17 and one half seconds. Back with you in a moment. All right, jumping right into an article from Durham about a new dashboard and a report aimed to move housing policy forward. Housing policy is one of the animating issues in Durham these days, and everybody and their NIMBY grandma has an opinion on how to approach that problem. A new website called the Durham Housing Dashboard offers a high-level look into the current state of housing in the Bull City, along with a report detailing recommendations to address everything from homelessness to affordable housing to home ownership. The dashboard shows data on ownership, rental affordability, housing supply, demographics, and the local economy in Durham, as well as a number of other peer cities. Boston, I'm not sure how that classifies as a peer city, Nashville, Denver, Minneapolis, Seattle, and more. For comparison, most of the current data set ends in 2023, but as new data becomes available, the dashboard will automatically update. The Durham Chamber Foundation, with funding from the City of Durham, Durham County, and Duke University, contracted with HR&A Advisors, a real estate and economic development consultancy, to create the dashboard. The Chamber previously ran the campaign for the 2019 Affordable Housing Bond. Matt Gladick, Vice President of Economic Development at Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, says that the goal of this was to get an independent organization that were experts in this to create a dashboard for us that houses our data as well as comparable peer city data so that organizations and people that are concerned about housing, affordability, and supply have the same set of data to work off of. Housing is one of the most significant challenges facing residents and local officials, but Durham isn't the only city staring down major growth in the coming years. So how does Durham stack up against its peers? Durham home values jumped during the pandemic. In 2020, the median home value was $280,000. Last year, it was $416,000. Other growing cities like Nashville and Denver incurred similar rates of growth, but Durham has maintained a relatively high rate of home ownership over the last decade at around 55%, compared to Nashville at 53%, Denver at 49%, and Boston at 35% of home ownership. 11% of Durham homeowners are cost burdened, meaning they spend between 30 and 49% of their household income on housing, and 7% are severely cost burdened, those who spend 50% or more on housing. Those numbers are slightly more favorable than other comparable cities. Renters have also seen an uptick in costs. The income required to afford median rent in Durham, $1,600 per month, is $55,200. That's compared to $42,000 and $1,272, respectively, back in 2020. Cities like Minneapolis and Seattle jumped at a similar rate, while Boston's median rent is almost $1,000 higher than it was just 5 years ago. And for a city that aims to be more densely populated, Durham's housing typology, that's the style of units, suggests it has ground to make up. This is interesting. 55% of Durham homes are single-family, which ranks higher compared to peer cities like Nashville, That's 50%. Minneapolis, 41%. Seattle, 38%. And Boston, 12% single-family housing. These data sets are only part of the picture, Gladick says, but they provide basic information about Durham housing in layman's terms, not in any specialized statistician or demographic terms. The Durham Housing Initiative Task Force, made up of dozens of representatives from nonprofits, faith-based organizations, developers, and others connected to housing work, published an accompanying 58-page report on the dashboard website that offers a comprehensive look at the past, present, and future of housing in Durham. Now, as an aside, folks, this 58-page report and what I'm reading to you is connected to a link. If IndyWeek.com has these links and they're available, and IndyWeek.com is a free publication. One can find it on the internet if you want. So I'll just mention that. City Council member Javiera Caballero was chosen to lead this task force, which is made up of five subcommittees: pre-housing shelter, supportive services, subsidy gap funding, workforce housing, and land use. These subcommittees made a number of recommendations that include items already in consideration by local leaders, like opening a day shelter, streamlining the city and county development review process, and prioritizing publicly owned land for affordable housing projects, as well as initiatives like a new affordable housing bond that would require long-term planning, longer term. Many of the recommendations were consistent across the subcommittees, Caballero says, underscoring that the need for more affordable housing is not the job or the burden of any one entity. She says, obviously the city is the lead agency for many of our strategies and work, and certainly funded a ton of housing units, but in my view that's a very limited way to look at housing. If you ask anyone in Durham, one of the top three issues they're going to tell you about housing, whether it's Duke hearing it because of their workforce or their students trying to find graduate student housing, DPS is in the same boat. So we need to get out of it's the city's job to solve the big problem. The city might be the lead agency, but they aren't the only agency building out Durham's housing supply. In May, the Renegade, a project on the 300 block of East Main Street that was developed on county-owned land, started taking applications. The city, county, and school system have also been working to build a collective record of all their publicly held land, including Durham's aging high schools, for potential future development. But publicly initiated projects are just one approach. The path forward requires a variety of methods and practitioners, as reflected in the flood of recent op-eds from city officials and vested private citizens on the subject. By the way, these op-eds are also links in this article. In 2019, residents voted to approve that $95 million housing bond, which the city coupled with other local and federal funding sources to build and repair thousands of affordable housing units. But with an increase in city and county property tax rates and the cost of living in recent years, residents may not have as much as an appetite for another housing bond. How far can the city go without raising taxes or without an increasingly less reliable source like federal funding? Caballero says, obviously money is great, but that was the other focus of the report. It's not just about money. What are the things that we're doing in our work that make it more difficult to deliver housing of all kinds, whether it's a market rate unit or a unit for a special population like a permanent supportive housing unit? The Durham Planning Department is in the process of writing a new Unified Development Ordinance, a UDO, to realign the rules for building with the UDO's sister document, the Comprehensive Plan. Housing Task Force representatives are hopeful that folks can find a consensus on what new rules will give Durham the best chance to build all the types of housing it needs to support the lives Durhamites seek to build for themselves. Gladick says, affordable housing is super important for Durham, but so is building the Novus on what was mostly a surface parking lot. We need both ends of that spectrum in Durham. He refers to a new luxury apartment building downtown. As we look to increase the quality of jobs in Durham, the Chamber works a lot with Durham Tech to make sure there is true economic and social mobility available in Durham. We need good jobs available to do that. And companies are interested in moving here when housing prices are affordable. As our prices go up, the companies that are interested in opening up and moving here or expanding are companies with really high-paying jobs, and we want a Durham that is economically and racially diverse. And so part of that is making sure that our housing stays affordable, and part of that is building housing. Last year, local officials traveled to St. Paul, Minneapolis, for an intercity visit to pick up tips and learn more about shifts in policy the Twin Cities recently implemented. In 21, St. Paul City Council passed a rent control ordinance, which caused an enormous drop in new construction and has received pushback from landlords who say it hurts their bottom line, and advocates who say the ordinance didn't go far enough when it was implemented in 2023. In neighborhood Minneapolis, the city saw a 20% decline in rental costs after eliminating single-family zoning, which allowed for additional housing types such as ADUs and duplexes in zoning districts previously restricted to only single-family homes, and parking mandates in 2017. Nashville, another peer city listed on the housing dashboard, has a population twice the size of Durham. In 23, they issued more than double the number of building permits as Durham for housing construction, but their homeownership rate, median rent, and median household income are roughly the same. Each policy decision is a lever that local officials have at their disposal to manage housing needs. While there is an opportunity to learn from peer cities, there's no guarantee that what worked in Minneapolis or Nashville would directly map onto Durham, especially given North Carolina's preemption laws. The report from the Housing Task Force highlights that everyone, whether you're abundance-pilled or a diehard NIMBY, has a stake in Durham's future growth and a part to play in finding solutions. And Gladick says, if anyone tells you there's a silver bullet for housing, they are lying or they don't know enough about the subject. I think the important thing to remember is that everyone wants housing to be affordable, and so we all might disagree on how to get there, but everyone wants the same goal. All right, next, from the Bull City, is Duke Energy liable for climate-related property damage? The state's first climate deception case unfurled Thursday in North Carolina's business court, where attorneys for the town of Carrboro and Duke Energy spent 6 hours sparring over legal arcana to answer a single question. Should a jury hear a case alleging that Duke Energy is responsible for lying about the link between climate change and extreme weather that has inflicted millions of dollars of property damage on the town? The case began in December of 2024 when Carrboro sued Duke Energy, alleging the utility has funded and promoted a decades-long deception campaign to dismiss the connection between fossil fuels and climate change. Long-term effects of the alleged deception reinforced the public's reliance on coal and natural gas, town attorneys argue, which led to increased greenhouse gas emissions and accelerated climate change in the form of heat waves, greater precipitation, intensified storms, and more flooding. Carborough has incurred millions of dollars in damages to 47 miles of roads and other town-owned property, allegedly because of more frequent and extreme weather that resulted from a warming planet. Matthew Quinn, a private attorney representing Carborough, said each step, boom, 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 is a natural sequence. The town sustained at least $20 million in damages to its buildings, equipment, and vehicles in July from Tropical Depression Chantal. Greensboro is seeking financial damages for the past harms, as well as future ones. Quinn likened the case to tobacco litigation. Our theory is that Duke's massive deception got everybody hooked on fossil fuels, like Philip Morris's and cigarettes, he told the court. Duke Energy argued that the complaint is baseless and should be dismissed. Hunter Bruton, an attorney for that utility, there are other emission sources. There is no way to trace a statement by Duke to a pothole in Carborough. These are novel claims. If the case goes to trial, Quinn said the town would present climate attribution scientists, experts who study the link between extreme weather events and climate change, to prove causality to a jury. Carborough says in its complaint the alleged deception began in earnest in the 1990s when several energy front groups, in part founded by Duke Energy, knew fossil fuel emissions were warming the planet but launched a public relations campaign rebutting that climate change was real. The Global Climate Coalition, of which Duke was an influential member, falsely claimed in a 1994 edition of Climate Watch Bulletin that new, quote, scientific evidence showed fossil fuels might help maintain, quote, an essential atmospheric balance, and that, quote, cutbacks in fossil fuel may actually enhance the greenhouse effect, says the complaint. Duke was also an active participant in the trade association, the Edison Electric Institute, which knew as early as 1968 that fossil fuels were altering the planet's atmosphere, according to the complaint. Yet, in 1991, the Edison Institute ran ads in magazines disputing climate change, including messages like, "How much are you willing to pay to solve a problem that may not exist?" And, "If the Earth is getting warmer, why is Kentucky getting colder?" Judge Mark Davis asked the attorneys if the case was about damages or, quote, an end run for policy change about permissible levels of emissions. Duke Energy attorneys responded, the only way to get exacerbated climate change is to have exacerbated emissions. They have to prove the campaign caused someone to increase emissions. Duke's greenhouse gas emissions will likely increase, at least in the near future. Earlier this year, the state legislature passed a bill, which became law over the governor's veto, that allowed Duke Energy to postpone meeting a key carbon reduction benchmark in state law. Just 4 years ago, state lawmakers had required the utility to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 70% by 2030. Duke said it could not achieve those reductions because of increased energy demand by data centers and other large industries. It plans to build several new natural gas plants, which are major sources of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas, to serve those customers. Now, state laws require the utility only to meet its ultimate goal of net zero emissions by 2050. Carborough alleges that Duke Energy's harms constitute a public and private nuisance because the town no longer has, quote, the use and enjoyment of its property. The utility's action also constitute, quote, trespass, they argue, because the floods, wind, heat waves, and storms from climate change enter and damage town property. Attorneys for Duke Energy seemed exasperated at the claim. We don't control the weather or the rain or the heat, which they're alleging is the trespass, said an attorney. Duke Energy must be held responsible for the consequences of their deception, Quinn concluded. Their position, quote, there are no legal consequences. They can say anything about their business models, and parties like Carborough can't pursue damages. there is legal redress. Causation should not be misunderstood, and Carborough's extreme damages should not be minimized. Davis did not rule on the case Thursday. He's asked the town and utility to submit by October 25 supplemental briefs on the issue of traceability, whether the climatic effects on Carborough can be linked to the alleged deception campaign. One more article specific to Durham, at least in the public era, public vein, new historic marker. How a deadly attack spurred North Carolina's first Pride March in Durham. Durham prepares for the city. Now, this was printed a week or two ago. Durham prepares for the city's annual Pride Parade on September 27, and an official commemoration of the very first gay rights march in the state is in the works. The new historical marker will recognize a 1981 Durham protest called Our Day Out that is considered North Carolina's first Pride March. It will be the first North Carolina historical marker to recognize the roots of the state's Pride celebrations. Leslie Leonard, administrator of the North Carolina Highway Historical Markers Program, says this would be the first marker to use LGBTQ letters on the marker and the first one that's overtly about North Carolina Pride, but I don't suspect it'll be the last one. The Our Day Out marker will read, quote, First LGBTQ Pride March in North Carolina, June 27, 1981, advocated for rights and visibility, sparked by deadly assault at Little River, 10 miles north. Now in production, the sign will be installed downtown in 2026, the exact location to be determined by State Department of Transportation. The 1981 march was spurred by a hate crime that killed a man from Mebane. On April 12, 1981, men wielding large sticks attacked sunbathers at a stretch of Little River known to be frequented by gay men. Four men were injured. Mark DeMarade, Daryl Jones, and Jerry Penny recovered, while Ronald Antonovich succumbed to his injuries and died April 15, 1981. Penny has long been active in Durham's LGBT community, including owning a gay nightclub called Boxers for many years, and he survived the attacks and remembers them vividly. He said, It was thrust upon me, this assault, but yet still it's kind of astonishing to think that something that you were involved in, there's a historical marker for. I'd much rather be remembered for my clubs or something like that, but I'll take what I can get. In addition to running Boxers, Penny also sponsored gay sports teams and events for HIV and AIDS victims. I contributed a lot, he said. The flags you walk under during gay pride, if they're still the same ones, I purchased those and donated those to gay pride and all kinds of stuff like that. So it's much nicer to be remembered for something like that than having your teeth knocked out, you know. Even so, Penny helped keep the story of Little River alive. Quote, On my Facebook page, for the past 10 years or so, on the anniversary of the event, I generally post the event and all the clippings and stuff I saved from the papers. And so it eventually got to be known again. And that's a really good thing because, I mean, truly, no one even remembered it after about 15 years. When Rougemont resident Whitney Barclay Denny read online about those attacks at Little River and the death of Ronald Antonovich, she didn't want him to be forgotten again. Quote, This guy died, and we still know not a ton about him in this horrific way, she said. And then there just really is not much remembrance of him. So I thought, well, what can I do? Barclay Denny decided to apply for a historical marker recognizing the Little River attacks and the subsequent Our Day Out March. She compiled all the historical documentation she could find, reaching out to those who lived through the events, like Penny and Wendy Jacobs, now a Durham County Commissioner. Barclay Denny said, You might not have time to go find a book about the history of Pride in Durham, but if you're just walking down the street, and you see this historic marker and you stop and you read it, you know that is going to stick with you. Something important happened there. Hooper Schultz, a history PhD candidate at UNC Chapel Hill, stressed that the 260-some people who gathered for that march in 1981 did so under different circumstances than Durham Pride today. Quote, "A lot of activists who were involved in Our Day Out were not thinking of it as a pride parade. They were thinking of it as a parade against brutality. It had a much sharper edge," said Schultz, who worked on a Museum of Durham history project focused on Our Day Out and gay rights organizations in Durham throughout the 1980s. He said there were many of them that were wearing paper bags over their heads. LGBTQ rights have come under renewed assault in much of the country of late, and even in Durham, the county commissioners recently withdrew sponsorship from this year's Durham Pride Parade for fear of losing federal funding, reports WUNC. Nevertheless, Durham Pride is now a community fixture with many corporate sponsors. For local advocates like Schultz and Barclay Denny, both the history immortalized by the marker and the public representation of LGBT community are significant. Barclay Denny says, "I think it's really important we remember where we came from, particularly in this time when there are so many attacks on the LGBT community, particularly trans folks, that we remember that we came a long way and we still have a long way to go." Now, the final chapter paragraph mentions these events which have already taken place. So I will stop it right there. And I'll take us over to Wake County commissioners who are weighing two sites for the Athens Drive Community Library replacement. When many Southwest Raleigh residents went to the polls in 2024 to cast a yes vote for Wake County's $142 million public library's bond, they expected that a successful referendum would ensure their community library would remain in their community. County staff, they say, had made the community that promise in 2022 after the library housed inside Athens Drive Magnet High School since it opened in 1978 was thrice threatened with closure and saw its operating hours starkly reduced due to safety concerns and the pandemic. Yvonne Brannan, a neighborhood activist and former county commissioner, wrote in an email to neighbors ahead of a community meeting at the Thomas Crowder Woodland Center on Saturday morning, which the Indy attended, wrote this: "We supported the bond based on this promise, and if we are betrayed, we should never forget it." Wake County Public Schools will begin renovations to that high school in 26, closing the library. The countywide bond allocates a total $67 million to build a new replacement for Athens Drive Library, as well as other community libraries in Rowlesville, Apex, Wendell, and Southeast Raleigh. Of that $67 million, the county has determined that $16.3 million is available for Athens Drive Library replacement. Now members of Wake County's Board of Commissioners, making steady progress in implementing that bond, are weighing two sites for the library replacement. One site, currently the home of retired restaurateur Arthur Gordon, well-fed community garden, is less than a quarter mile away on Athens Drive, just a four-minute walk from the library's current location. The Indy reported earlier this year on a rezoning application Gordon and his wife Anya had filed with the City of Raleigh to build affordable housing on the two-parcel property, but the Gordons withdrew their application in July. The other site is 3 miles, or a 10-minute drive away, and located in another town, Cary, at the intersection of Tryon Road and Yates Mill Pond. WCPSS currently owns the site in Cary, which at more than 12 acres is much larger and would provide ample space for parking. The county would have to buy the well-fed community garden site from the Gordons. The site is 2.6 acres, would require a two-story facility, and it's valued at around $840,000 for the combined two parcels. District 2, Wake County Commissioner Celia Jackson, attended Saturday's community meeting. While her district covers Fuquay, Verina, Holly Springs, and Garner, Jackson told the 70-some residents in attendance that she was happy to have a conversation with them about the library, as she is one of the seven commissioners who will have to make a final decision on the site. County leaders, Jackson told the crowd, have to consider certain criteria in evaluating where to locate the replacement, including what seems to be the county's principal guiding metric, how many people in the county live within a 10-minute drive of a new library. But, Jackson emphasized, no decisions will be made based on that single factor, and the county will also consider growth patterns. 66 move to Wake County every day, and the cost of land in, quote, the equation of where we move the library, next door or 5 minutes away. Saying your community connections, walkability, history, reach, people that are already in this community, these are considerations, as well as the larger amounts of Wake County who are able to drive to a library. Residents at the meeting said overall, the better choice to keep the library close is clear. Their community is one of the densest and fastest growing areas of the city, home to thousands of young families and well served with walkable roads and sidewalks, bike lanes, and public transit. Joe Hartman, who lives near the library, recently turned 80, quote, we have good potential for infill and for land saving. Two-story construction of a library building without suburban sprawl. Other residents called the 10-minute drive metric arbitrary and pointed out that the Cary site, while it technically has more residents within a 10-minute drive, is not located along any public transit routes. President Jamie Hammerman, who has been taking her daughter to Athens Drive since she was 8 months old, has conducted extensive research on the demographics and amenities around the two sites, including economic diversity and public transit access. Hammerman's research showed that a few hundred households, or a fraction of a percentage of the overall county population, live within a 10-minute drive of the Cary site, a nominal increase over the number of households served by keeping the drive library in its current part of town. Hammerman said, who would actually benefit are some pretty wealthy neighborhoods. Jane Harrison, Raleigh City Council representative for Raleigh's District D, which includes Athens Drive, supports keeping the library in Southwest Raleigh. She noted, how much new affordable housing has been built and is currently planned for that area, including new projects on Kent Road, Lorimer and Garland, Trailwood Drive, and Hope Village on Method Road, which will provide new homes for students aging out of foster care. These are all in addition to existing affordable housing, including the Raleigh Housing Authority's Kentwood development on Kent Road, just south of Western Boulevard. Harrison said, it's not just one or two developments. We are in several qualified census tracts right around here, so they're qualified for low-income housing tax credit projects. This is all within this neighborhood. We're going to continue to see that added density, and I just want to make sure we have infrastructure and amenities to serve our population. Jackson said it's not clear when the county commissioners will make a decision about the site, saying the meeting marked her first conversation with the community. It won't be the last. She promised to review the feedback and get answers to questions that arose for her during the meeting. She said, I will be transparent, however I vote, about how that decision is made. We're not going to be voting in 2 weeks, so there is time. But for the residents, it is a matter of trust. Brannon, a former county commissioner at the end of the meeting, said, let's not play any games. Nobody's going to fool this community or any voter that the replacement meant. Now we can have an opportunity to close Athens Drive Library and set up a regional library in Cary. We voted for the bond. I've sat in the seat. I know the pressure, but I can tell you one thing you can't do to the public. You could not lose their trust. Well, over to Orange County and Orange County schools in specific. Fewer kids, stalled raises. What's ahead? The last time Orange County commissioners and school board members held a joint meeting, the local officials agonized over how to maintain quality public education without making the county even less affordable. 4 months later, even with budget discussions over and a new school year underway, the boards are still dealing with many of the same issues: rising costs, uncertain federal funding, declining enrollment, and pressure to keep county tax hikes to a minimum. At a joint meeting this week, members of the Orange County Commission, the Orange County School Board, OCS, and the Chapel Hill Carrollborough City Schools, CHC, board tried to lay out some sort of path forward, and while the vibes were friendly among the electeds, the conversation itself was a bit grim. Here are four takeaways about the future of K-12 education in Orange County. 1. Both districts are opening new elementary schools soon. That's thanks to a $300 million bond referendum to support school facilities approved by about two-thirds of county residents in 24. OCS has determined that the most urgent priority is the construction of a new elementary school near Gravely Hill Middle School. Officials hope to open the new school for the fall of 2029, though Chief Operating Officer Frederick Davis warned construction timelines can always get complicated, especially with a project that involves both the county and a school board. That's a notable development, given there have been some vague discussions about whether the district should consider closing elementary schools in response to lagging enrollment. More on that later. CHC is planning to replace Carrollborough Elementary on the existing site. Students will remain in the existing building until the new one is complete. CHC Deputy Superintendent Al Chirochi said, "We are aggressively targeting the fall of 2028, but he noted they had the flexibility to continue into 2029. Officials have emphasized that these are not expansion projects, but necessary replacements because the existing buildings are reaching the end of their life cycle. This is not a capacity project, said Chirochi. This is a replacement project. 2, schools are not happy about the state budget standoff. While municipalities have had their budgets squared away since June, the state legislature still has not passed a statewide budget, instead continuing at previous funding levels. As a result, teachers whose pay is set by the state haven't received a raise, even though a pay bump was outlined in drafts put forth by the House, the Senate, and the governor. That paralysis means the district cannot be entirely sure how much money they'll eventually get from the state. CHC Chief Financial Officer Jonathan Scott told the group, "It's been indicated to us that the General Assembly does not really have time to even take up budgeting until November of 2025. Scott's OCS counterpart, Rhonda Rath, echoed some of his presentation, adding, quote, "We are being very conservative, very thoughtful in our spending, and we are just continuing to review all of our departmental budgets, scaling back where we can, and whether it is appropriate with school outcomes being our priority." Next, 3, when it comes to staffing, retention is the new recruitment. That line, dropped several times by OCS Superintendent Daniel Jones at the meeting, refers to staffing challenges both districts have faced in recent years. And developments like that, lack of a state budget, are probably not helping much in convincing people to pursue the noble profession of educating our nation's youth. with North Carolina teacher pay among the lowest in the country. CHC Chief Human Resource Officer Ashauna Harris pointed out that while vacancies continue to be a problem, the pipeline of new teachers is also weakening. Quote, "We know that teacher education programs are no longer producing the number of educators that they have in previous years, so we are working very hard to retain the staff that we do have." While CHC is overall at 98% of full staffing levels, roles for those working with children with special needs, often initialized as EC or exceptional children, lag behind at about 93%. Harris said, hopefully our state government will make some moves and make some improvements in salaries, but right now this is a very difficult position to fill because those EC classrooms, those are really tough assignments. OCS has a similar rate of vacancy amongst EC staff, which drew a question from Commissioner Phyllis Portier-Ascott. Question, for the EC teacher vacancies, how are we covering the classes? Is it that we're using substitutes or doubling up on the classes, or what are we doing to educate those students? OCS Rath said the district was using long-term subs, especially by recruiting already retired instructors for help and by providing stipends to other teachers who step in. That shortage also applies to non-teaching staff. The bus driver shortage has caused major drama in other districts, especially Durham, though Harris noted that CHC has been able to use existing staff to avoid that kind of crisis. We are not 100% staffed, but I will say the entire Office of Transportation, down to the directors, the bookkeepers, everyone drives a bus. Finally, Orange County is getting older and fewer kids are enrolling in schools. Thank you. That was very depressing, said board member Barbara Fedders after a presentation on the county's demographics. While Orange County is growing overall, that is, the county population is expected to be 30% higher in 2050, its youngest population group is not. In the Chapel Hill-Carborough area, for instance, the population under 5 years old has declined by about 11% in the past 10 years. CHC Superintendent Rodney Trice showed a graph of kindergarten enrollment over the past 10 years with a plot line that took a big hit in 2020 and has continued to slope downward. Trice said, "There are just fewer school-aged children enrolling in our schools. But it's not just about birth rates. It's about housing cost and availability, squeezing young families out. That's a problem for school systems that receive funding based on enrollment numbers. The districts have long been aware of this problem, but it didn't make the solutions seem any easier. CHC officials have already discussed the future possibility of closing an elementary school to consolidate resources, which is sure to cause some strife for parents and teachers alike. Commissioner Jean Hamilton wondered if the board could better anticipate future class sizes by tracking ongoing construction, especially in the dense Chapel Hill-Carborough area. Hamilton suggested that the planning departments across Orange County government could help by giving a sense of what's being built at what price point, which may indicate whether or not children may move in there. Well, let's move into a broader subject. Heather Lee, L-E-A-H, Raleigh's hidden historian. Heather Lee likes to play a game where she picks a spot in Raleigh and asks herself what stood there 50, 100, or 200 years ago. Consider State Parking Lot 20 on the corner of Blunt and Jones Street, just across from the governor's mansion. A century ago, Meredith College students studied there in a stately Queen Anne-style mansion, bedecked with turrets, gables, and wraparound porches. After Meredith relocated to Hillsborough Street, the building was converted into a hotel, then an office building, then demolished in 1967. Venture down an overgrown footpath off of Peace Street and discover a hidden riverbed flanked by stone walls. It's one of the last vestiges of the Devereux Meadow baseball stadium, where various minor league baseball teams played between 1945 and 1971. The river was routed underground in 1930s to make room for the ballpark. Today, it's been paved over in most places. In the spot where the North Raleigh Hilton stands, colonial North Carolinians gathered 200 years ago in Isaac Hunter's Tavern, an establishment so popular among politicians of the day that the General Assembly passed a resolution in the late 1700s requiring the new state capital be located within 10 miles of it. That tavern has long since been demolished, but it hasn't been forgotten, at least not by Leah. A local historian, author, and tour guide, she specializes in documenting and sharing Raleigh's hidden histories and forgotten landmarks. And she says, I'm trying to find these places that you maybe walk past or over top of. You don't even realize that something important happened there. I'm trying to talk to people who remember those times and document their stories. A fifth-generation Raleighite, Heather Lieb, began blogging about local history on a whim in 2012. She liked the idea of writing about her home city, but never planned for the blog to become a full-time job. She remembers, my dad built me this website, and he goes, this website's going to be more valuable to your career than your college degree. And I was like, no way, absolutely not. But I did it to spend time with him. One of her first viral posts was about that village subway, an abandoned underground mall beneath the village district and a hub for Raleigh's punk music scene in the 70s and 80s. That's 1970s and 80s. Leah found a few photos of the village subway in its heyday, so she gathered oral histories from the people who used to work and play down there. She says, that became a crystallizing moment where I saw how history can create community. People who hadn't seen their friends in 50 years were finding each other in my comments section. Bands that hadn't played together since the 1970s reunited. After Leah's blog took off, news stations hired her to produce hidden history segments, and the great Raleigh Trolley tapped her as a tour guide. She was invited to speak at community events and appointed to the Raleigh Historic Development Commission. As her dad predicted, Leah made a career as a local historian and recently wrote a book about North Carolina's ghost towns and lost communities, set to be published this January. On her blog, she's written about how thousands of people freed from slavery moved into freedmen's villages around Raleigh after the Civil War. Most of these villages were wiped off the map, but Method and Oberlin Village remain. She explains, those villages were often forced to be in low-lying areas prone to flooding, down by the railroad tracks, or places where you're going to have trouble building generational wealth. If you look at the landscape of Raleigh today, a lot of the places where these villages were struggling are places now where the community does not have as much money. That's why history is so important. It's not just about the nostalgia. It's also understanding why your city looks the way it does and why some of the struggles that exist today exist. Raleigh's fast-growing population has created a debate among residents about how to balance historic preservation with new development. As a historian and longtime resident, Leah has a nuanced perspective. She says, I do want to see Raleigh grow. I'm not totally scared of development. I want there to be growth and change. But it breaks my heart when they just tear down an extremely culturally interesting or significant place. Leah advocates for adaptive reuse, or renovating historic structures for new purposes. the Raleigh Iron Works, Durham's American Tobacco Campus, and Rocky Mount Mills are good examples. She says those places are all the cooler because of adaptive reuse. Developers need to think in terms of using what's already there, and I think they'll be celebrated because of it. She also knows some buildings will inevitably be lost. At least document it, she says. Allow a team of professionals to go in and photograph it for historic references. Let's make sure, if we're going to tear a place down or close it permanently, we make sure it's not forgotten. What to see on Triangle Stages this fall? I understand my audience is not all the visual sort, but many of these items, I'm sure, have contemporaneous audio descriptions. At any rate, I'm going to tell you about them anyhow. Playmakers Repertories, company's fall season, helps settle a timely debate. Chapel Hill is no football town. It's a basketball and women's soccer town. With Rajiv Joseph's King James about the rise of LeBron James and this culture of fandom around him, and Sarah Delap's critically lauded The Wolves, an exhilarating look inside the drama of a high school girls soccer team, Playmakers illuminates two of its hometown's favorite pastime in two riveting plays. Audiences throughout the Triangle will have a special opportunity to see King James. After a short run in Chapel Hill, which has now ended, Playmakers taking its show on the road with stops at venues like Motor Co. Music Hall in Durham, the Chatham Public Library, and more. Preceding King James and the Wolves on Playmakers stage is yet another play about sports, inspired by the life of barrier-breaking boxer Jack Johnson. The Royale follows the boxing champion as he fights for wins both inside and outside the ring. Now, coming right up, Dambuzzo, October 2nd. That's the day you'll hear this first. At the Fruit, Dambuzzo. Multi-hyphenate artist Nora Chipomiri describes Dambuzzo as an anti-genre work. If you've never heard that term before, you're not alone. But the moment you step into one of the expansive worlds Chipomiri creates in her intense and enigmatic performance, you'll understand exactly what she means. Blending sculpture, sound installation, dance, painting, and more. Dambuzzo, meaning trouble in Shona, which is native to Zimbabwe, confronts legacies of colonialism through a Zimbabwe Shabini. That is described as an informal bar set up in private homes where citizens gather to evoke the possibilities of resistance and insurrection in the face of political powers. Next, Nole Timere at NC State Live Stewart Theater. I will happen to be attending this. The title of Rebecca Lazier's later work, a collaboration with a sculptor, is Latin for "Be Not Afraid," though the director probably refers more to the existential challenges of our world. There is indeed more to fear here, and on the other hand, more to be awed by than your average dance performance. The dancing takes place on two of Eichelman's stunning dynamic net sculptures suspended 25 feet in the air. Those sculptures and the precarious and thrilling ways the dancers navigate them are meant to represent the fragility and interconnectedness of our lives. In addition to being a dance performance, a sculpture installation, and a feat of engineering, Nole Timere may also be a lesson in survival. Again, at Stewart Theater, tickets can be gained for that at the NC State Stewart Theater box office October 10 and 11. All right, fans of That OK Go music video, this one's for you at October 28th and 9th. Burnout Paradise, an interactive performance by experimental Australian theatre company Pony Cam. Four performers must complete a series of tasks, make a meal, do some paperwork, attempt self-care, all while running, and of course dancing, on four treadmills. The metaphor for modern life may be obvious, but doesn't make it any less prescient. And as Pony Cam artists grapple with their own relationships to burnout and make difficult choices about what to prioritize within the ridiculous game they've created, They find both levity and profundity in the messy piles of to-do lists that comprise being human today. Now, November 12th and 13th, 12th through 23rd, Theater Raleigh Arts Center, Once on This Island. Mid-November sounds like a good time to be transported to a Caribbean island. Rather than heading to RDU, navigate to Theater Raleigh, where the company will take on Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty's magical and beloved musical, Once on This Island. Based on the book My Love, My Love by Rosa Guy, which itself is based on The Little Mermaid, Once on This Island follows a peasant girl and rich boy who fall in love, despite the stark class divisions of their island. Don't worry, things end slightly better than they did for those other star-crossed lovers. All right, on into November, the Thanksgiving play. If you've had the cringe-worthy experience of recalling or seeing photos of the historically inaccurate Thanksgiving pageants, allow the Thanksgiving play to give you a different reason to cringe. At least now you'll also be suppressing giggles. Written by Native American playwright Larissa Fast Horse and fresh off a 2023 Broadway run, Thanksgiving play pokes fun at a performative wokeness by following a few well-intentioned teachers as they try to create a Thanksgiving play of their own. You guessed it, things go horribly wrong. Raleigh Troupe, the Justice Theater Project, will put out the well-timed production, which is hilarious as it is brutally biting. That's between November 14th and 23rd at the Justice Theater Project at the Church of the Nativity. The last one I have time to read is Taylor Max Holiday Sauce, Duke Art Presents at Reynolds Theater, Durham, December 4 to 6. If your holiday viewing appetite is typically filled by the Nutcracker, Christmas Carols, and Hallmark Channel, gird your loins, Taylor Max, the performance artist best known for the marathon durational work, a 24-decade history of popular music, has a different kind of December tradition with holiday sauce. Full of Mac's equally gorgeous and irreverent interpretations of the songs you love and love to hate, plus some clever originals, Holiday Sauce reclaims the holidays from the claws of capitalism and gives them a hearty injection of absurdity and fabulousness. That's December 4th through 6th at Reynolds Industries Theater in Durham. That's all the time I have to read today. And so John Federson will read the next issue of Independent Indie Week next week on the North Carolina Reading Service. And this production will magically turn into a podcast after we broadcast it once on Friday afternoons. Thanks very much to listening to ncreadingservice.org. For Indie Week, John Federson says, goodbye.